I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. For a long time, dairy farms have been a large part of the Wisconsin landscape and culture, and for a long time, the number of farms has been dropping. But is the family farm about to make a comeback? There are some reasons to think that it might, and we'll find out about those and a lot of other things having to do with dairying. From Doug Reinemann, he's professor of biological sciences engineering at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have given this talk called Buckets to Robots, which right away is fascinating, because I think most of us don't consider robots as part of farming, but we'll get to that later and see how it all came about. I was surprised to learn that in 1885 there were 200,000 dairy farms just in Wisconsin.
Yes, it's an extraordinary number. And, you know, back in those days, every farm had a cow, and farms were very small. And a large part of the production for those farms was just for purposes of self-sufficiency to feed themselves. And then one of the things that was an attractive product for the cash market would be butter in particular, and eggs and things like that that could be easily transported without spoiling to a place where you could sell them.
And these were family farms. Most of the labor came from those large farm families at a time when the population was burgeoning. But what was the process in 1885 for actually producing dairy products?
Well, at that point, I came across a fascinating picture of a farmstead in 1885, and one of the things that really stood out to me was that the farmhouse was as big as the barn. So, you know, large families and a relatively small number of animals. So in those days, cows would have been pastured, and the milking would have been done by hand. There might have been a cream separator on the farm that was hand-operated. You cranked the crank to separate the cream from the milk, and then the cream would be turned to butter on the farm with typically, again, hand labor with a butter churn. And so the amount of manual labor at that point in history was just unimaginable to us today. You know, people literally work from sunup to sundown to do all of the things that machines do today.
Which right away implies that there's a limit to how big a family dairy farm could be.
That's right.
Because it takes a certain amount of time. Is there this formula for how many cows you want per hour you want to spend milking them?
Yes. Well, so I've been doing work with dairy farms in Wisconsin for about 30 years, and you know, it's a remarkably durable sort of goal for dairy farms is to be able to milk the cows in 2 hours because of all the other things that have to be done on the farm. So when people milk by hand, you know, it took a lot longer to milk a cow. So the number of cows on the farm was much smaller. You know, 2 hours to milk and then, you know, the other hours in the day to gather the feed and you know, grow the crops and, you know, all the other things that had to be done.
But you're milking them, what, two or three times a day?
The standard for most of the history of dairy farms has been twice a day. So you milk the cows in the morning and the evening. And only recently have we started milking cows more frequently. So a new dairy farm almost anywhere in the world with automation would typically be milking the cows three times a day. Maybe a little more than that in a robotic milking system, but that's a relatively recent change that has been the result of automation of the process.
Do you have a sense of how much of the output was for sale and how much was for family consumption?
Back in, say, the turn of the century, 1900-ish, I don't have a good number on that, but I'm guessing that of the total production of a farm back then, certainly less than half would typically be sold to market. So I would guess, you know, maybe somewhere depending on, you know, it really depends on how close you were to market. So farms that were closer to big cities probably exported more, sold more. Farms that didn't have access to those markets probably sold much less.
What were they doing for refrigeration in 1885, 1895?
Springs, water. So the way that milk was cooled until, again, quite recently in the history of agriculture, you'd put your milk in a bucket and a can. And the can you would put in a water bath that was had water. If you were lucky, you had a spring, cold water coming, you know, to fill a tank. You set your milk bucket in. Otherwise, you'd pump it from the ground. So the old windmills that you see, you know, the fan type windmills, they were used for pumping water, and part of that water was for the, you know, the people and the animals, and part of that water was used to cool the milk.
Did any of the milk go to animals?
Yes, it did. So again, depending on how many cows you had, particularly in 1900, most farms were multi-purpose farms. So they weren't strictly dairy farms. They grew everything they needed to eat, and they had some cows and some chickens and some pigs. And so typically the family would take the fluid milk that they would consume directly, that came sort of off first. And then the cream would be separated to make butter and the skim milk. And in those days, the skim milk went to feed animals. You'd feed the skim milk to the pigs and the chickens, and that was part of, you know, their feed.
Is this because it wasn't really considered desirable for human consumption, or because it was just a matter of practicality?
It's a sort of combination. So, you know, the people would drink the whole milk. And, you know, in those days, skim milk was not something that people drank because, you know, they preferred the whole milk. And there was a whole different consciousness about health and butterfat and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it did provide a useful input to other parts of the operation, so that skim milk fed the pigs, and then you eventually would eat the pig. And so, you know, it was all
you get it one way or the other.
Yeah, it was all part of a big system. So, you know, back in those days, farms were a much sort of more complicated system of production that include, you know, vegetables and field crops and feed for the animals and food for the people and all different kinds of animal agriculture that all kind of worked together.
Where did pasteurization come in? Was that something that became a legal necessity fairly quickly, or where did it come in?
It did become a requirement, a legal requirement, and that actually happened in the early 1900s. And one of the big concerns, one of the reasons that pasteurization became required, was to stop the spread of tuberculosis. So tuberculosis was a disease that could be transmitted through milk. So a cow with a disease could transmit the disease to people in the milk. So that was the primary reason that pasteurization began to be practiced, is for the quality of milk to prevent the spread of diseases to people.
And that was a technology that would have been available to your typical dairy farm in Wisconsin in 1890 or so?
No, so it's a technology that even today is not done on farms. It's done at a milk processing plant. So, you know, sort of in the early 1900s, particularly in the 1920s, 1930s, we started to see more milk plants be developed in Wisconsin. And in those days, they called them creameries. So, you know, people would bring, again, part of the issue was transportation. Rather than transporting all the milk, they would bring the higher value product, the cream, to the creamery. And the creamery would do pasteurization and make butter. Particularly if you were producing milk for fluid consumption, the pasteurization would be done at a milk plant because it's really not practical or wasn't economical to do it on the farm.
And then would that be true also of homogenization? Why was that considered desirable?
So homogenizing is a process by which, you know, we've been talking a lot about butterfat. So if you milk a cow and you put the milk on, you know, in the refrigerator or on the shelf somewhere, right? What happens is the butterfat separates. So the butterfat forms a layer on the top, And so because butter floats, it, you know, it does the separation thing. So to make the product, particularly fluid milk, more shelf-stable, the homogenization breaks the butterfat up into very tiny particles, so from larger to smaller, and that just slows down the separation process. So I can have a 2% milk or a 3% milk, and I can put it on the shelf in the grocery store, and the butterfat won't separate out. It'll stay, you know, 3% milk through the whole gallon of milk.
If we go back to this graph, let's call it, of number of farms in Wisconsin, which I gather kind of reflects the country at large in terms of the dairy industry.
Yeah.
200,000 farms in 1885. By the time we get to, let's say, electrification in the 1930s, what's happened and why?
So the by the 30s, and particularly, so the W.D. Hoard, and you know, during that period, the early 1900s, from about the 1920s to 1930s, Wisconsin became the dairy state. So that was a time when, prior to that, Wisconsin was a major wheat producer. And for really the natural advantage of Wisconsin, dairying was a way of getting the maximum profit out of a piece of land in Wisconsin. So because of our climate, you know, we're not as competitive in producing wheat as, say, states like the Dakotas, which were developing at that time. And we're very good at growing forages. You know, we're not quite as good at growing corn as, you know, the Corn Belt, like Iowa, Indiana, Illinois. We're a little cooler than that. You know, we have a little more rolling topography. So growing forages is something that we do very well in Wisconsin. So W.D. Hoard and folks of that era were looked around, and they kind of said, you know, this is really a great place to do dairy farming. And that's really when Wisconsin became specialized and farms became more specialized as dairy farms.
But getting back to this number of dairy farms, you're saying that the number of farms didn't necessarily precipitously decline at that time, but the number of specifically dairy farms did?
The farms became more specialized. So the number of farms with dairy cows became fewer. So, you know, 1900, you might have one or two cows primarily to provide milk for the family. By the 1920s and 1930s, now we have like six dairy cows, maybe 10 dairy cows, something, you know, like that. So it's much more than producing much more milk than the family needs. And now it became really a commercial enterprise to sell that milk off the farm. And with the introduction of milking machines getting electricity to the farm enabled farms to get milking machines in a more economical and practical way. That made it possible to milk more cows. So during that period of the 20s, 30s, and even into the 1940s, you know, parts of Wisconsin were not electrified until the 1940s, the late 1940s, some parts even the early 1950s. You know, that's really when the number of cows on a farm would have expanded when the automation, the milking machine technology came in.
Well, let me ask a question this way. How easy with automation was it to milk those cows? Was it easier than doing it by hand in the long run?
Yes. So one of the things I do when I'm talking particularly to a dairy group is I ask how many people have milked a cow. And in Wisconsin, usually a large number of hand goes up. And when I say how many of you have milked a cow by hand, it's a much smaller number. And if you've ever done it, it's really hard physical work. You know, you have to develop muscles in your hands and your arms that most people don't have. Right. So it's really, you know, the difference between milking by hand and even the simplest bucket milking machine is extraordinary. I mean, I would say it just time wise, it would take you about four times longer to milk by hand than with the simplest milking machine.
OK, so it's roughly four times more efficient. So you could have four times the number of cows that you could milk in that same two-hour time frame that you allocated back, you know, in the 1880s. And so a real burgeoning of dairy farms when we get electrification and
yep.
this degree of automation in the form of the milking machines.
That's right.
Well, so what's the turning point then after that? I mean...
Well, you know, it's really been a progression, really, from the start of agriculture. You know, there isn't a point where you can say there was a real dramatic change. It's just been a steady progression of increased automation, more cows per farm, fewer people employed in agriculture. And, you know, so like every 20 years ago or 20 years or so, there's sort of a new wave of technology. But, you know, it takes a while for that to be adopted. So you don't see like a big change immediately. But, you know, it takes a while for that adoption to get through the market. So it's really, if you look at the numbers, sort of just a very steady progression that hasn't stopped and is not likely to stop in our lifetimes.
That applies also to the grazing. So we determined that early on they were all pasture fed.
Yes.
But at some point that moves into the barns, into the milking sheds, milking parlors.
Yes. Well, you know, Wisconsin, again, because of its sort of unique environmental attributes, there have always been cows grazed in Wisconsin. And just, you know, you have got a very steep field that you don't want to plant in corn, for example. And you know, it's hard to cut the grass. You know, it's not flat. It's steep. And so, you know, there's been parts of the state, particularly in the Southwest, where grazing just makes sense because it's much more efficient to send the cow out to eat the grass than it is to try to get a tractor, you know, harvest. So, again, it's never really stopped. Most farms, I would say most large farms, don't practice grazing anymore, but there are still a number of small farms that do some amount of grazing. Some farms do much more than others. So there's some farms that try to do, you know, as much grazing as they can.
Free-range cows, I guess you'd
yes,
call them.
Yeah. During the summertime.
Yeah, sure.
So that's our challenge for grazing is during the wintertime, you know, of course, there's no grass growing. You can't send the cows out in the field. So, you know, even those farms, they might get almost all their nutrition from a pasture in the summertime, but in the wintertime, they still have to rely on some stored feed.
Does the milk, the chemistry of the milk change then seasonally?
It does, yeah. Cool. It does, and that's a bit of a challenge for, you know, cheesemakers. And there are some cheeses that are made with milk from cows that are on pasture. The Europeans have some very strict rules about this. So a particular type of cheese, you can't call it that cheese unless it was made from milk from cows that were on pasture. It means you can only make that cheese during a certain time of the year.
We're going to look at the ongoing automation, and we get into some really kind of almost science fiction after a while here when we get into the present and the future of the dairy industry, which we will do shortly. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Doug Reinemann, and we're looking at the present now and the future of dairying in Wisconsin, and by implication, the future of dairying in much of the rest of the country. And it also, as it turns out, turns global before too long. Well, we've talked about this technology, Doug, and going from the 19th century into the early 20th with electrification and automation, milking machines and that kind of thing. So are those developments something that's likely to eclipse the family farm?
Well, it's a question that is of enormous interest to me. So I, of course, have been studying dairy technology for 30 years as a professor at the university, and I am really enormously interested in what effects technology has on people's lives, and particularly rural communities in Wisconsin. So it's one of the sort of games I play with myself is, okay, if we took this technology and it were adopted in a big way in Wisconsin, how would that change the structure of rural communities? What kind of jobs would we be creating? How many jobs? You know, how does that translate into the quality of people's lives and the economy of the state?
So
technology has allowed the increase in the size of dairy farms, and that's a trend that's been going on for a long time and is likely to continue. And one of the sort of limits on the size of a dairy farm at this point is no longer technology. It has more to do with environmental regulation, environmental consequence. So that's sort of where we are in that size of dairy farm thing is, there are certain environmental challenges when you get more and more cows concentrated into a small area. And that's something we're, at the university spending a lot of time thinking about and looking at and wrestling with this question of the environmental consequence of dairy farming. But from a technology standpoint, small farms, as well as big farms, have adopted technology. And so right now in the history of dairy farms, so you could say that, technology really has enabled small farms to survive for a lot of years because, you just couldn't do the manual work required of dairy farming without the technology, particularly on a small farm. So, that will continue, and this whole question of robotic milking raises some interesting questions about whether or not that benefits smaller farms, larger farms, family farms. And right now, robotic milking is being adopted primarily on small farms. So it's benefiting those small family-owned, I'd like to refer to them as owner-operator farms in Wisconsin.
Who owns the big farms?
Well, in Wisconsin and really in most of the country, in most of the U.S., farms are owned by families. So they're family businesses, and it's also sort of part of the evolution of dairy farms. So, we have a dairy farm, and then there's always a point of transition when you get a new generation coming into the business. So the children of the dairy farm family either come back into the business as business partners, or they go off and do something else. And so the typical large farm of Wisconsin is a family, a group of family members, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, grandfathers, who have put together a business that's jointly owned by this family. And the number of families kind of determines the size of the farm and the number of cows on that farm.
Well, before we get into robotics, what are some of the automation features that lead us up to that?
Yeah, so, going from hand milking, so the first step was, when you hand milk a cow, you sort of squeeze the udder with your hands, right? So the first thing is we got a machine to do the squeezing. Big advance.
Pretty impressive, too.
Yeah.
There must have been some awful miscalculations
there were.
At first.
It took a while to work out the bugs on that one. And then sort of the next step was, so in the bucket systems, you had to, the milking machine would move the milk from the cow into the bucket, but you had to carry the bucket someplace and then come back. So the next advance was pipeline systems to move the milk so the person didn't have to transport the milk. And then the next step in automation was the removal of the milking device. So in most milking parlors today, even a person is there to clean the udder and attach the milking machine, but the task of removing the milking machine from the cow when the cow's finished milking was automated in the 1970s, 1980s.
It's not sure there's a distinction that's quite valid here, but it sounds as if it becomes a little bit more like factory work. I mean, I guess you're going to have these repetitive stress problems with any kind of approach, whether it's hand milking or, you know, manipulating the milking machines.
Yes. And so you know, the physical challenges have always been there, and the specific types of physical challenges sort of change with the technology. So, you know, the 1900s, it's hands, arthritis in your hands. And then when we went to milking machines, it was hips and knees. So you have to bend down. So now if I get a milking machine, I can milk more cows, but I'm bending down under that cow to attach it, to remove it many, many times a day. So that now it moves the stress from the hands to the knees and hips.
So Wisconsin becomes, what, a leader in hip replacement surgery?
That's right. At one time in history, I think in the 1970s or so, and maybe even still, Wisconsin had the highest number of knee and hip replacements per capita of any state in the nation.
So what did they do next then to avoid that? Just wouldn't it make sense to move the cow up higher so that you don't have to bend down to do this process?
That was the next step. So in milking parlors, the cow walks up, you know, to a platform. And so the person now is working in an upright position. And that's the point at which the removal of the milking device was also automated. So now a person is just cleaning the udder and attaching the milking units. But again, they're doing many, many more cows. So they're doing that particular motion more and more often, and that moves the stress to lower back, shoulders, elbows.
Well, where do you go from there?
That's where robots come in.
The robots. Now, this is a fascinating concept, and I've heard you say that actually cows prefer the company of robots to people, at least in terms of the milking procedure.
It's one of the very clear observations made by anyone who goes into a robotic milking barn. The cows are calm, they're happy, and part of the reason for that is they control their own schedule, and there aren't people that are pushing them around, you know, go here now, go there now. The cows move of their own voluntary will.
Wait a minute. So instead of having these like two or three sets of milkings a day, the cows just kind of wander up to the robot whenever they feel like getting milked?
That's right. So in a traditional milking parlor system, the cows would be brought as a group of 100 or 150 cows, something like that. Those cows are moved from their place where they're housed, their freestall area, into a holding area. And then there's a gate that sort of pushes them through the milking parlor. And so that's all, you know, that's very regimented kind of activity. It's time to milk now. Everyone's got to go. Yeah. And with a robotic milking barn, the cows go to the robot whenever they want to. They're not moving in a huge group. They're typically moving around as individuals, or ideally, we're studying this right now, cows sort of form smaller social groups. So there might be a group of like three cows that are friends.
Come on, Elsie, let's go get milked.
Yeah. And they move together. It's like, okay, you know, it's the three of us. Okay, let's go and, you know, get milked. And that provides, you know, it's a social contact for them, but also it provides them like protection from the boss cow. And so it's a much more sort of natural social environment for the cows in a robot barn.
It's strictly a matter of when they feel like going that's going to attract them to this robot milker?
Yeah, so it's one of the challenges of managing a robotic milking barn is, you know, you have to get the cows moving and you have to get them in often enough. And so there's a lot of thought going into how do we design the barn to make it so that cows, or it's easy for cows to move. And then how do we provide some incentives for them to go into the milking robot?
Right.
And that's primarily food. So we give them some high energy, you know, sweet stuff, and, you know, they get some cow candy, and that is the primary motivator for them to go into the milking stall.
What's to stop them from going up there even when they don't need to get milk if they just want the candy?
So when the cow presents itself to be milked, there's a management computer. So first of all, the cow has to be identified, and the management computer will figure out when the last time that cow was milked. And if, you know, she's just been here, the robot computer says, sorry.
No candy.
And then she gets, you know, kicked out. No, yeah, no candy for you. Out you go. And then she'll come back, you know, at a point when it's either a certain amount of time has passed or when she's got enough milk accumulated in her udder that it's practical to milk her again.
And somehow this milk for the day, I'll call it, is collected, but in sort of varying batches from day to day. I mean, how do you kind of regulate that sort of milking in terms of the product that you get out of it?
You know, the milk quality, there's, again, been a lot of studies on that. So the quality of the milk coming out of robot barns is very comparable to any other type of system. And one of the advantages that the robots have is that, you know, cows go through a lactation cycle, and during their peak lactation, they're producing lots of milk. And then as they go through the lactation cycle, they gradually produce less milk.
Sure.
So with the robot system, you can actually adjust the milking frequency to make the, you know, that whole process much more uniform.
To match the kind of diminishing output.
Exactly.
And how do you regulate the quantity that you get from any given day if there's not this kind of mass routine behind the milking?
Well, you get, I mean, in a large milking parlor, a large milking parlor typically is going to run 24 hours. It runs around the clock. So there's always milk coming out
okay.
of it. And so with a milking parlor, you know, you're milking maybe 20 or 40 cows at a time. And so you've got the milk from those, you know, 40 cows going into the bulk tank. With a robot, you're milking one cow at a time in each robot. And typically, you know, a farm might have, let's say, four robots. So there's sort of four cows milking all the time, and they run round the clock as well.
And these robots are economical enough that a relatively small farm can afford them. You're saying that actually the small farms are maybe at this point the biggest customers for these robots.
They are the biggest customers, and there's a cost premium for them. So it's a bit more expensive way to milk cows than a traditional parlor. But particularly the smaller farms, and I like to refer them as owner-operators. So they own the farm, but they also provide a significant amount of the labor to run the farm. So that's the operator part. So they're the owners and they're the workers. And for those kind of farms that you know, are primarily operated by family without a lot of hired labor, they're willing to pay that premium to allow them to stay in the dairy business and improve their quality of life. And so, you know, at this point in history, those smaller farms are buying this technology, and it's an additional cost that they're willing to bear because of the improved quality of life.
And you've touched on this question of labor beyond the farm family. That seems to have been a phenomenon that had a fairly short duration then. As you've said, still a lot of these farms are still, of course, owner-operated. But for a time, it seems as if there was hired labor. And then what happened? Did the cost get too great? Or why did that phase out in terms of in favor of automation?
Yeah, and there still is quite a lot of hired labor on farms because, you know, only a small, very small percentage of farms are milking with robots in Wisconsin today. You know, it's less than 1%. So most farms, particularly larger farms, rely on a considerable amount of hired labor. And, you know, 30 years ago when I started in this business, most of that labor came from the surrounding community. And then we started seeing more Hispanic labor in milking parlors. And now the estimates are something that, you know, maybe 60% of farm labor is Hispanic laborers.
How do you account for that change?
Well, there's two things. I mean, when I talk to dairy farmers, you know, it's difficult to find labor in rural Wisconsin. And so, you know, there's the local, and there are fewer people in rural Wisconsin. So it just became harder and harder and harder to find people from the local community who were willing or available to do farm labor. And that's when we started to see immigrant labor starting to take those jobs. Those are people who were willing and available to do that work. And that's grown from, you know, starting in sort of the maybe 1980s up until the present, it's been a steady increase in immigrant labor on dairy farms in Wisconsin. And that's not unique to Wisconsin. That's happening all over the world.
So give us an idea of what a really large dairy farm would look like.
So a large dairy farm would have typically a series of barns, what we refer to as freestall barns. So the barn is, for a point of reference, you know, could be about the size of a football field. So it's a very large building. Typically, the sidewalls are open. It's a very open building. There's pens, and in each of those pens, typically a barn would be divided into four sort of quadrants. So it'd have sort of four large pens. In each of those pens, there are resting areas for the cows. Those are the free stalls, and those stalls are places where the cows can lie down and rest and sleep. And those stalls typically are filled with sand. So that's sort of the premium. So the cows go and lay on a
just
sand
bed. Just because it's comfortable? Is that the idea?
It's comfortable and it's also hygienic. So it doesn't promote bacteria growth. It drains easily. So it's we try to keep cows dry, clean, comfortable. And sand is the bedding that does the best job of that.
And that good old-fashioned pasture plays what part in this big farm of ours?
So the fields surrounding this farm are producing corn and alfalfa and soybeans, and those things get harvested and processed, and we make something called silage, which is a way of storing dairy feeds. There's an ensiling process. In the old days, those used to be tower silos. So the typical dairy farm from 30 years ago was a little red wooden barn.
Are we seeing these big white caterpillar looking things? That's silage under there?
That'd be silage or hay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, or it's either the silage bags that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just a big pile covered by a plastic tarp. I was just at a program yesterday. There's some research being done on using wax to cover the silage, which the cows can then eat, so you don't have all this plastic flying
around.
Oh,
what a nice idea.
So, yeah, there's a huge place to store the feed. And then the feed would get mixed, and the feed is a sort of a recipe of a lot of different things that gets mixed up in a feed room, and then it's brought to the barn with a tractor and wagon, and then there's a feed area that adjoins the resting area. So what cows do is they rest, they get up, they go and eat. If it's a traditional parlor freestyle operation, they go eat, then they come back and rest, and then they go eat, and they come back and rest, and then every once in a while they get taken off to get milked. In a robot barn, they have the op. So in that cycle, in that resting eating cycle, they can also go to be milked. So in a robot barn, it's rest, milk, eat, rest, eat, rest, eat, milk.
So they're getting away from what used to be, I think, like an early morning milking and then the evening milking. It's just kind of, as you say, it's just 24 hours.
Continuous. Yeah. But each cow would typically be milked maybe three times a day. You know, a lower producing cow, maybe twice a day. A higher producing cow, maybe four times a day. But on average, about three times a day, they go to get milked.
And then once they stop producing, what's the future for that cow?
Well, so a big part of dairy production is reproduction. So sometime during the lactation cycle, the cow is bred and then she makes a calf. And well, so she actually finishes her lactation, she has a calf, and then she starts another lactation. So, and a cow would go through something like three lactations. And then at some point, when she's no longer a lactating cow, she would be sold as a beef cow. So she would be sold into the food market as
so like Holstein would qualify as a beef cow. Well, at that point,
Holstein beef, it's typically, it's, you know, it's not the same as, you know, Black Angus,
right,
prime cut beef. It's you know, typically goes into things like hamburger.
We're going to look further at the future of dairy farming and the environment when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Doug Reinemann, and we're looking at the future now of dairying in Wisconsin and, by extension, as it turns out, the world. Let's start with this question, Doug. Price of milk. Go to buy a gallon, let's say, skim milk. I don't think it makes a lot of difference whether it's skim or whole. Maybe $1.75, $1.80 a gallon. Even a large farm, an automated farm, how can it sustain itself at that price?
Yeah, so the price of milk right now is very low, and the thing that's most concerning, you know, the price of milk has always had some cycling to it, but the thing that's unusual about the dairy markets right now is the price of milk has been very low for a very long time. So we're going into sort of a fourth year of very low milk prices.
Why is demand down?
Demand is down, and so the price of milk has increasingly been tied to the world price of milk. So the price of that a farmer gets for his milk in Wisconsin has been increasingly locked into the world price of milk.
Why are we selling on the world market?
Yeah, so in the last 10 years or so, the U.S. dairy industry, in order to expand its production, started to do more exporting of milk, dairy products. And so right now, the U.S. is exporting around about 15%, maybe 17% of dairy products from the U.S. are exported. And that has that's enough export to influence the price of milk to lock it into the world market. So it's not just that demand for dairy products in the U.S. have gone down. They've gone down slightly, but they're fairly stable. But it's really that the world demand has gone down and the supply is up. It's the price of milk is very sensitive to the supply and the demand.
So is Wisconsin competing then with Germany and Holland and places like that?
Competing with the Europeans to some degree, and they're certainly world players, but New Zealand is a big player in the international dairy markets. And China's a huge player. It's become a huge player. Both as a purchaser, but now as a producer of dairy products.
What part does in this price slump, I'll call it, what part does alternative, whatever you want to call them, milk products, artificial milks, alternative milks, I guess you could call them, although even that would be a little bit controversial. Has that played any part in this price effect?
Yeah, I think it's had some influence, although I don't think it's a huge influence yet. Dietary preferences in the U.S. are changing. They tend to change relatively slowly, but, you know, there are more and more people who are preferring, you know, non-animal food products, including both meat and dairy products. And there's the market has responded by producing, you know, non-animal products to fill that gap. And, you know, that has had some influence. And I think that trend will continue, that sort of shift in dietary preference. But I'd also have to say that even though there's been a decline in the consumption of fluid milk, the consumption of cheese has actually gone up. So pizza in particular has really
well,
helped out
true.
The dairy industry.
Yes.
So, you know, the U.S. demand is, you know, fairly stable, but it is changing. And that's something that, you know, the dairy industry is well aware of and needs to respond to.
Agriculture has been in the news for a long time in the context of environmental problems, specifically having to do with water.
Yeah.
And what are the prospects for ameliorating that problem?
It's something that a lot of people are putting a lot of thought and effort into. There's a regulatory component. So, you know, we're in regular discussions with the DNR and the Department of Ag. And it's certainly not unique to dairy. It's, you know, any crop that's grown, there's some fertilizer applied. And the concerns relate to both surface water, which is, you know, primarily a phosphorus issue, but also groundwater, which is sort of more a nitrogen issue. So, you know, there's lots of work going on trying to manage the nutrients that are used to produce corn and soybeans and potatoes and, you know, you name it. And I think the thing that complicates dairy is that one of the major nutrients used to produce dairy feeds is dairy manure. So dairy manure presents, you know, it's a little more complicated to deal with manure than it is to deal with a bag of fertilizer. The constituents are a little less uniform, there's a lot more volume, so there are some additional challenges when you're working with a dairy system to get the manure nutrients back onto the land in a way that's environmentally sustainable.
Relationship between the dairy industry and ethanol?
Yeah, so dairy industry and ethanol is a good partnership. Ethanol, so I like to think of it that we grow corn, and on the way from the field to the dairy farm, it stops at the ethanol plant. So the corn goes to the ethanol plant, and they extract some of the mainly carbon out of the corn to make the ethanol, some of the energy. But the distiller's grains, the remaining part of the corn that isn't made into alcohol, ethanol, is a dairy feed. So there are a lot of ethanol plants. I think most ethanol plants will have an arrangement to ship their distiller's grains to a dairy farm, either directly as a wet product, or they might dry it and ship it as a dry product.
Is there a connection or a possible connection between the manure and ethanol production?
Not really, because, manure... Well, if you think about it this way, the dairy cow has already taken all the energy out of the feed. So there's not a lot of energy left in the manure, or at least the kind of energy that we want to make ethanol out of. So it's not a great feedstock for ethanol. However, it's a great feedstock for anaerobic digestion and making biogas. and that biogas can be used to produce electricity. So that's more the energy connection on manure, is that it can be digested and used to generate electrical energy.
So will there be farms? Are there farms already that are energy self-sufficient that way?
Yes, and Wisconsin has, I think, is still the state with the most anaerobic digesters in the country. And a farm with a digester produces more energy than it consumes.
So it can sell to the power companies.
That's right. It sells. And unfortunately, right now, the price that farms are getting for that green energy has gone down considerably. So that's pretty much stopped the installation of new biogas generators as the Public Service Commission changed the rules about the buyback rate for green energy. So it's no longer economically viable to invest in that technology for energy production.
What do you see in the future then? Which way is dairy farming likely to go? We have these robots. We also have the big automated, milking parlors with hundreds, even thousands of cows, and lots of technology on the horizon. But where do you see Wisconsin farms in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think we will see. I'm pretty sure we'll see both, and just because of the nature of Wisconsin landscape, I mean, I think we'll always have small farms, a range of farm sizes in Wisconsin. And I have to say, one of the things, I'm sort of getting nearer the end of my career than the beginning. I'm really doing everything that I can do to try to keep dairy farming diversified in Wisconsin. I think there's a lot of good social reasons. I think there's a lot of good economic reasons. I think there's a lot of good environmental reasons to keep as many smaller operations in business and avoid this concentration of very few, very large operations. So, that's one of my challenges. And one of the things I'm always looking at is how can we make the smaller, more environmentally friendly operations more dispersed across the countryside economically viable.
Still a matter, though, do you think, of farms that are specifically dairy farms rather than the older concept of more diverse, raising some of everything? Do you think they'll continue to be specialized as dairy farms?
I think so, because dairying is it's really a high tech industry, and even if you're small, it requires a lot of management skill. So you need a certain amount of dairy management ability to run a dairy farm, and so I think diversified farming is more likely to be in, I would say, the more niche markets, sort of the CSA type farms, very, very specialized products. But in terms of, real dairy farms, I think it's very, very difficult to diversify because you have to have so much knowledge and investment in a dairy operation.
And there are enough young people going into the business, dairying, to sustain it?
For the moment, yes. And that's another thing that, I'm really interested in, is how do you make the lifestyle on a dairy farm attractive enough so that young people are wanting to do it?
Is it easier with the automation?
Definitely. Definitely.
Doug Reinemann has been my guest for this hour. We're looking at dairy farming and gotten a good background as to what it used to be like and some notion of what it will look like in Wisconsin in the near future. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.